Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
I bet it's been a while since you've heard that one. G'day. Thanks to Vanessa from Banksia. And I'm Rob Trojan. Welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy, and historical radio for episode number 1598, entitled Podysseus. Our co-host Megan McHugh is off on a homewards bound odyssey herself today, so it's me, Jan, solo today. We would like to acknowledge traditional owners of the lands of the Wurundjeri from which we broadcast from and to, and to elders past, present, and future. Well, did want to actually mention right up the top of the program, don't forget that there is a nationwide test of the Oz Alert mobile phone test system, which is happening today at around about 2 p.m. So if you want to find out more, I just found out some more details about it, Services Australia website at MyGov, but I'm sure any sort of search will tell you about the test that's going on it too. So basically it's going to put up an alert on your mobile phone, as it says on the tin, although it never works out well in Doctor Who, does it? But we'll see how it goes. All right, I'm just reminding myself just so I make sure that I turn my phone off, because 2 p.m., you know, zero G, swapping over with Astral Glamour, and I don't want that interrupting proceedings. But, of course, it is something about communications, and kind of in a way, that's what we're talking about today, in a way. It's odd, you see, but clearly Christopher Nolan's new movie has hit a homer run. I do not think I've seen quite such a wholehearted embrace by pop culture about a book. Well, technically already an adaptation of an epic poem, but who's scribing? About a book, embracing a book-to-screen adaptation and the source's author, since the BBC Pride and Prejudice sparked a revival of Austenism. So yes, I've seen The Odyssey at IMAX Melbourne, as Nolan intended. Well, clearly not me specifically, but very much IMAX anyway, and I have lots of thoughts about the whole thing. Given the epic poem's origin as a performance piece, I am bemused that everyone keeps forgetting that Christopher Nolan is essentially just another bard, perfectly entitled by the rules of Hermes to interpret it as he may, to be judged on the applause of the audience. In this case, it is obviously quite considerable if you've seen the box office. And then, you know, you can move on from and then to the next performer and so on. This is the evolving kleos, the glory or renown of the Odyssey, which is considerable and way more enduring, 3,000 years and still going strong, than the shabby war that was its ostensible and maybe notional prologue. Homer wrote the Odyssey down about the 8th or 7th century BC, Homer may not have been one single person. We don't know for sure. The odds are that they were. But, you know, we're talking about an odyssey here, not just odds. And as with William Shakespeare and his plays and Sir Thomas Malory and the Matter of Arthur, Homer built upon a body of much earlier work with a strong emphasis in Homer's case upon spoken word performances, repeating and building upon popular and enduring stories which may or may not have actual historical basis. And the last point does matter, but not as much as you might think, although I am amused to contemplate some wandering bard, or in Greece, where they called the performers rhapsodes, thousands of years ago, prefacing their oration with the phrase, The following is inspired by real events. Like Shakespeare and Mallory, Homer was writing about actual or legendary events and many combinations thereof that they believe may have been set much earlier in history, around the 13th or 12th century BC, based around the Trojan War. So, Homer could have been writing about something 600 odd years after the notional fact, and consequently there are obvious anachronisms contained within their account, just as you see in Shakespeare and Mallory's work about their subjects. And that said, it's actually remarkable that Homer did nail certain things quite well, like the distinctive helmets covered in boar tusks that they mention. I don't think I need to explain the main events of the Trojan War, really. I mean, it's been 3,000 years. I think it's been well spoiled. Besides, maybe you've saw Wolfgang Petersen's film Troy. So, the Iliad, which covers a few weeks during the 10-year siege of Troy in the latter part of the Trojan War, and the Odyssey, which covers chunks of the aftermath, particularly from the perspective of the captain Odysseus as he tries to get home back to Ithaca. And by the way, the Iliad doesn't mention the Epomimus Trojan horse at all. It's deftly but not extensively sketched in the Odyssey, but you have to wait until about 30 BC for the Roman poet Virgil to get a much more fulsome hypothetical picture of the horse and the fall of Troy in his epic poem, the Aeneid, where Virgil famously co-opts Trojan survivors and sends them wandering off to eventually help found the city of Rome. The Romans incidentally called Odysseus Ulysses. So the Iliad, the Odyssey and the Aeneid all were the bestsellers of their day, and with some blips ever after, actually some large blips at times, hundreds of years, and they became staples, or stables, both as books or rather scrolls, and they also were continuously performed in hall and in theatres, as well as inspiring the arts from sculpture through to pottery, paintings, tiled frescoes, embellishments on armour and other kit, and music. Yes, there was merch. A lot of what I can call fan fiction was written too. Everybody, for example, wanted Odysseus's children, legitimate or otherwise, to go off and found cities. Their cities. And the Odyssey itself has bits bolted onto close pot loopholes and all sorts of things. Stop those hecklers from saying, but what about? Ha ha. Yes. And there have been, of course, multiple translations into English throughout the years. The one I most read recently was Emily Watson's one in 2017, which was the first English translation by a woman of the Odyssey. She has also done excellent translations of the Iliad and the Aeneid as well. Now, the Odyssey and the Iliad and so on have been co-opted by others, just as Homer's work was incorporated other traditions, including that of the Gilgamesh cycle. Reboots and spin-offs have been done. If you come into the later years, way out of the classical ages, Dante's Inferno has extensive pieces lifted from the Odyssey in terms of characters and so on. The Arabic tales of Sinbad the Sailor, very much referential to the Odyssey in their own way. Tennyson's poem, Ulysses, of course. And then, of course, there's James Joyce's Ulysses in 1922. Margaret Atwood has written about the women of the Odyssey and the Iliad. There were two books recently, well, when I'm talking 3,000 years, recently is 1994 and 2002, which were written by a psychiatrist, Jonathan Shea. One of them was Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. And the other one was Odysseus in America, Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming. Both of those talk about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or in the case of the Odyssey, post-Troy siege disorder. And talking about the about combat veteran patients and their rehabilitation histories. And that's very actually important in the context of Sidney Nolan's The Odyssey. So it's often frequently cited, The Odyssey, that is, as proto-science fiction, often adapted into science fiction stories in literature. Of course, David Drake's Cross the Stars, one of his Hammer Slammers stories. Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, 2001, A Space Odyssey, the movie. So alongside all of those traditional arts, painting, sculpting, theatre, opera, music, comic books, graphic novels, for the past century and a half, we have film and television, both small and large screen, and in the IMAX case, a very large screen, live-action productions or animated and so on. So many of those. And I will get into those in a minute. What will I give you next as a track, though? I think I'll go for a one called... Ulysses by Lionel Lerov, and this is basically it's called Ulysses. It's the theme song to the Ulysses 31 animated series, and the artist is Lionel Leroy in this. And this is a little bit of a longer version of the main title theme from that, but if you're of a certain age, you will remember that television series, which is set in the far future, but nevertheless is about Ulysses and his voyage home from the Trojan Wars, or similar in context of the science fiction television show, an animated one, that is.
Hello, I'm Ray Harryhausen, animation pioneer. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM.
Yeah, you heard Ulysses, in case you didn't get the lyric there. Ulysses 31, the animated series, an extended main title theme there by Lionel Leroy from the animated series, which we'll get to in a moment. Ulysses, of course, is what people who have gone Roman call Odysseus, and we are talking about Odysseus, the Odyssey, today, Christopher Nolan's one. We'll get to there eventually. Wander around a bit, stop off a few scenic islands and all that kind of thing before we get there. And I'm talking about the last 100 or so years of Odysseus Odyssey adaptations on screens, large and small at the moment. I think one of the first ones was a small silent film called Ulysses and the Giant Polyphemus, which is the Cyclops, of course. So you can imagine that would have been a guy in a mask, basically, perhaps winking at the audience, not getting a large rocket in his eye, unlike the Méliès movie. Or does he? I don't know. I haven't actually seen it. It is probably available online. I will check that out. The 1911 silent movie, L'Odyssée, directed by Giuseppe Di Liguoro, was another one. The one that most people of a certain age remember will be the 1954 Mario Camerini's directed Ulysses, which had Kirk Douglas swashbuckling his way through it. And the Cyclops scene, of course, gave me nightmares at the time. Not so much because it was a giant distorted human with that big one eye in his forehead, but possibly because they made him drunk in this one. And I found that the combination of this drunken giant rampaging around very scary. I'm not surprised that it gave me the jeebies back in the day. The sequence was actually directed by Giallo pioneer Mario Bava. And that, you know, he's the guy who did all those, pioneered the Italian horror movies that have echoed on through the eternity of horror cinema ever since. So, yeah, it would be scary. I rewatched the movie the other day. It didn't quite hold up as well as I remembered it. And the last time I saw it was probably in black and white. So it actually, in terms of hitting me in the eye with colour, actually was quite memorable in that. But in other aspects, it didn't feel as quite a good a movie as it should have been, produced by Dino De Laurentiis. So that does tell you certain things. And I remember that Silvana Mangano played both Circe and Penelope. I am assuming a certain knowledge out there about the Odyssey and some of the tropes. It's been 3,000 years. Come on. So, yeah, playing the dual role of two of the characters, which sort of lets Odysseus or Ulysses off the hook a little bit for infidelity during his wandering home, because, after all, Circe looks so much like his wife. In that one, she gets to turn the men into swine with a bit of fog machine jiggery-pokery, and she has the memorable line, "It was easier to do than you think," which is quite arch, actually. And, of course, it has that sad scene where Argos the dog greets Ulysses when he comes home, being over the age of 20, which is quite considerable for a dog, and looks at him briefly, wags his tail, and then just dies, sadly. That scene gets me no matter what interpretation or adaptation of the Odyssey I see. I'm always in tears after that one. In this case, Kirk Douglas was too, which I thought was a good touch. And how could it not fail to move you, even though he'd been moving quite a bit in the past 10 or so years trying to get back home? Now, these films that I wanted to underline here are not strictly about the Odyssey, but they are the most powerful films about the prologue and aftermath of the Trojan War that you might want to check out. They are based upon the plays of Euripides, and the guy behind them is Michael Kakiovannis, who did Zorba the Greek and the Cold War drama, The Day the Fish Came Out, as well. Excellent movies coming out in, 1962, Elektra. Not the Marvel assassin, but that's the one where they explore Agamemnon's murder after the war at the hands of his wife and childhood friend. Then there's the Trojan Women in 1971, which is about what happened to the female survivors of the sack of the city of Troy. And that had an incredible cast of Katharine Hepburn, Vanessa Redgrave, Genevieve Bujold, Patrick McGee, and Brian Blessed doing some bit of roaring around in there. Such a bleak film, but so key to understanding the aftermath of the siege and to getting a more human-faced, and in this case a more feminist-based approach to what is often just seen as this big sort of male stoush, even though it is ostensibly about rescuing Helen of Troy from the clutches of Paris, even though she may not want to be rescued. Iphigenia in 1977, which is about Agamemnon's daughter who he sacrifices before swanning off to Troy. Also seen themes of that in the 2017 Yorgos Lanthimos' movie The Killing of a Sacred Deer. So what they call the Greek trilogy of director Michael Kakiannis there, worth checking out if you can get hold of copies of those. And then, of course, there's the several movies based around James Joyce's book Ulysses, the 1967 film Ulysses, and also Bloom. You know, there's a lot of adaptations that are on film and on television that are basically the Odyssey, but by other means, including, of course, the Coen brothers' O Brother, Where Art Thou? And there actually is a Harold and Kumar Escape Guantanamo Bay, which has kind of got similar themes. There's La Odyssea, a 1968 multinational miniseries, which is quite highly regarded. I have not seen it, but I might check it out someday. And, of course, we played the theme before of Ulysses 31, which was a two-season French-Japanese TV animated series set in the 31st century. There was also an animated Australian adaptation for kids of the Odyssey from 1987. And thinking of Odyssean things, I am amused to recall that Xena, warrior princess, and her crew had several encounters with Homeric stories. I played the distinctive Joseph Leduca soundtrack main title theme for Xena, warrior princess, at the top of the show. There's an episode called Beware Greeks Bearing Gifts, where Xena and sidekick Gabrielle show up at the Troy City Stoush and enjoy some epic horseplay. No wicker horses were harmed in the making of that show, but plenty of lawn chairs gave their lives for it. Then there's one where at the Athens City Academy of Performing Bards, Gabby competes against Homer and Euripides in a bard fight. The episode Ulysses sees our heroines helping Ulysses, or Odysseus in Greek, regain his throne in Ithaca. And the massacre of the suitors is ably aided and abetted by Xena. And by the way, Autolycus, played by Bruce Campbell in the Xena and Hercules movies, Prince of Thieves, self-styled, was Odysseus' granddad in the stories of the Odyssey, but appears unrelated in the Xena and Hercules shows, apart from that proclivity to be a thief. And speaking of Hercules, the legendary journeys, one of the telemovies that kicked off the Sam Raimi series, Hercules and the Lost Kingdom, I think the entry was vaguely Homer-related as the eponymous, but not pony mock, no timber horsey in this one. The kingdom, the Lost Kingdom in the title, turned out to be Troy. So, when you ever do adaptations of things, eventually they get round to becoming comedies. And in 1991, the Italians did a comedy called The Odyssey, a TV show for that. And the next one of note, really, I have glossed over some of those, and I shouldn't really, Italian shows, you know, Hercules versus Ulysses and Samson and Hercules, da-da-da-da. There's a great number of titles for that. Those sorts of movies where they just do basically fan fiction of teaming them up in their movies. I shouldn't pass those. They're great sword and sandals epics. just amazing sort of things if you've ever seen them. I used to watch them on Epic Theatre on Saturday afternoons. But now they're the sort of things you can find on Tubi and Plex and so on. All right, so the next big one was the 1997 Odyssey, which was a television miniseries directed by Andrei Konchalovsky. And I think that one also had special effects by the Jim Henson Creature Shop, but it had Armand Asante playing Odysseus. Another one that I stumbled across recently is a science fiction movie called Ulysses, A Dark Odyssey, which is set in the United States of Europe in 2023, you know, future back then when it was made in 18, which has a soldier who's got amnesia trying to get home from a Middle Eastern war. And so he has to try and find his wife Penelope in a dark city where he has a number of adventures that sort of parallel the episodes of the Odyssey. One which I have not checked out and probably won't, considering how soft I am on animals, Ulysses Dog, which is a film set made in 2024. So quite recent, really. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'll be able to check that out. Sorry, Guillermo Amengual, director. It might be too much for me. You know, and the Zero-G sort of tradition of saying nothing bad happens to the dog in the film or cat. In this case, of course, it is the Odyssey and the dog does die and people are mean to it along the way and it just, you know, breaks my heart. All right, never mind about the sack of Troy and so on, but yeah, all right. And the last movie I've watched about the Odyssey is actually about the last couple of books. There are 24 in all within Homer's Odyssey. The Return, a 2024 film starring Ralph Fiennes, who is tortured by exercise in this, where he buffed up to play the role, and very suffering a whole lot from post-Troy siege disorder in this one. He is lost in so many ways, and now he finds himself washed up literally on the shores of his beloved home island of Ithaca. It's directed by Umberto Pasolini and stars Ralph Fiennes as Odysseus and Juliette Binoche as Penelope. It's a bleak exercise, but a very good entry in the story as well of Odyssean adaptations too. And I feel like it almost could be said to inform a little bit of the Nolan movie too. But, you know, maybe not. We have, because there's a whole lot of things that Nolan has obviously vacuumed up and had a look at. We'll get to that in a moment. So what will we play next? A little bit of a track here first from The Voyage of Ulysses, a television show, another adaptation by Bernard Grimaldi, which is kind of epic in a small screen way in and of itself. So this is The Voyage of Ulysses.
Show some love for our 50th.
Got something to tell us? It's Triple R's 50th year and we'd love to hear from you. For a limited time, call Triple R to leave a special birthday message. How does listening to Triple R make you feel? Or perhaps your favourite Triple R moment? What keeps you tuning in to 102.7 FM? It's your opportunity to share with the Triple R community what Triple R means to you. We're 50. Aren't we entitled to a bit of love? Call us on 9388 1027 and press option 3.
50 years of Triple R.
Hi, this is Jeff Wayne, composer and producer of my musical version of H.G. Wells' classic science fiction story, The War of the Worlds, supporting The War on Terror, that's T-E-R-R-A, on 0G, on 3-triple Oola FM.
Just thinking of Jeff Wayne there with his rock opera Spartacus as well, going back into the ancient world, but of course a bit further on from the Trojan War and the Odyssey and so on. Although, as I was saying earlier on today about Virgil's Aeneid, which is basically the Roman attempt to co-opt the story of Odysseus, Ulysses, and justify the noble lineage of their own ruling Claudian family as being traceable back to the city of Troy and refugees fleeing from that awful conflict. Now, on to the Nolan, which I have seen at IMAX, as Nolan intended. And can you shorten that? A-N-I? Anai, yes. Anai to that. As I'm sure you know, and on the track I played just before was Ulysses, Lionel Lerov, I believe, from a television series, and we've gone through a few of them and talked about those briefly just to show sorts of things. As I'm sure you know, it's easy enough, because I'm reminded by this because I saw the San Diego Comic Convention drops about Avengers Doomsday. As I'm sure you know, it's easy enough to get a mostly Marvel Cinematic Universe fix from the Odyssey with some incursions into other fictional verses, which is to say in Chris Nolan's adaptation of the Odyssey. It can be described as an Asgardian actor who played Loki, tired of following King Batman, is guided by goddess Mary Jane Watson in his quest to return home to his wife, Catwoman, and son Spider-Man, a journey where at one point he's given hospitality by Clea, one of the sorceresses of the MCU, and finds out that Spidey isn't at home. He's gone to visit the Punisher on his island, as well as Nakia and her twin sister, Nakia 2.0. And Catwoman, by the way, is being pestered by another Batman, who also seems a bit of a vampire, so he may actually be Man-Bat, judging by his leech-like ways. And the Asgardian actor's companions on his voyage home include Dr. Watson, Luther Banks, formerly of the Advanced Threat Containment Unit, Shocker, Gordon the Inhuman, and Kenichiro Harada, the Silver Samurai. Oh, and by the way, they left Kitty Pryde back on the beach at Troy. That's one way of looking at it. I said that Matt Damon from from one of the Loki movies was tired of following King Batman because Agamemnon's armour, as I'm sure you've heard, looks a little bit like a sort of an ancient world Batman in the film. So, okay, The Odyssey, 2026, the big film at the moment, as big as Pride and Prejudice was back in the day as a BBC adaptation, sparking a vast new interest in Homer, just as that did for Jane Austen. Wow. Nolan directed it and produced it with his wife Emma Thomas. Very important to know that. Now, Nolan looked at several translations of the Odyssey, including Emily Wilson's brilliant 2017 one, which is extremely accessible She's rejigged it in iambic pentameters, so very Shakespearean in the reading of it, and it's very accessible. And she has translated several things, not, I don't think, controversially, but to make it easier to read in the 21st century. Like at one stage, she does capture the essence of Odysseus, who sort of demurs from taking part in a running competition, saying that, you know, I've been shipwrecked on a raft for a while. I haven't been able to do my exercise routine. And he actually calls it exercise routine. And it's perfectly understandable that he won't be able to do that. Other times she'll use the word daddy when there's a princess asking for her father for a favour and so on. There's lots of not anachronisms really, because she's translating them. There is something to be said that you might lose some of the Homeric language, but as the other ones, other translations are just that. You know, who can understand the wonder and the mystery of it all? Now, Noland has also looked to films like Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev and Kurosawa's Ran, as well as some of the films that special effect artist Ray Harryhausen did. You know, I'm thinking of Jason and the Argonauts and so on, with their kinds of sequences and the look of those films. Now, they filmed the Odyssey all over the world, appropriately Morocco, Sahara, Western Sahara, Malta, Iceland, Italy, Scotland, as well as in Los Angeles. It is an extraordinarily expensive film, $250 million US, which is the biggest budget Nolan's had, and it is the first feature film ever to be shot entirely on IMAX's 70mm film cameras. And I had heard that IMAX Melbourne is the only cinema in the Southern Hemisphere that you can go and see this as Nolan intended, in that 70mm format on an actual IMAX film projector, because I think they took the one out of the Sydney IMAX at some stage. So, you know, you've got people flying into these IMAXs that can still play the 70mm film all over the world, trying to get to them because they have to watch it. ANI. All right, so, look, my point really today is that Nolan is the latest bard or rhapsode to tackle the Odyssey. And he is going to look at it through a contemporary eye, as every other player and filmmaker has before him. So I'm not at all concerned about a lot of issues that perhaps normally would have hit me in the eye. But this case, no, I don't worry about it. You know, there's things about it. They're using a replica Viking ship to go on their little voyage. No problem really there. They're trying to make it look like at least one type of ship that might have been used at the time. And the main reason why they did that was because it's actually proven seaworthy, whereas a replica that they tooled up for this might not be. I could have liked to have seen a different type of ship, and I do miss the big eye on the front and the red cheeks and all of that sort of thing. But again, I miss it, but I'm not going to choose that particular whirlpool to drown in, just as I'm not even going to worry about the about diversity in the casting. It means nothing. It actually is meaningless, and you can just move on without even worrying about it, in context of the Odyssey especially. I mean, I'm sure other people have covered that more than enough, and I don't need to. Let's have a track here from the movie The Odyssey, with Ludwig Göransson at the helm. Of course, Mandalorian and all of those other great soundtracks that he has done over the time, and he's done a great job of going back and resurrecting some original Greek instruments, and also doing a lot of inventive percussion as well. And this is Zeus's Law, which is a critical component of Nolan's The Odyssey by Ludwig Göransson.
Oh, this is me, right?
Right, voiceover time. Avast there, mateys. This is Captain John English, and you'll be listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM. Pirate radio, har har. Beware of cheap pirate copies.
Yeah, that was Ludwig Göransson's track from The Odyssey, Zeus's Law, which is a terribly important concept in Christopher Nolan's new film. John English there was also the guy who did the Paris Rock Opera, which is based upon the Iliad and the Odyssey, and probably the Aeneid as well, come to think of it, since the horsey isn't actually in the Iliad. All right, so let's mention Zeus's Law there, the title of that track, in terms of the Odyssey. This is a hugely important concept in Christopher Nolan's film, which obviously being an adaptation of the Odyssey shows the character of Odysseus travelling back to his island of Ithaca, having already spent 10 years at the siege of Troy and trying to get back home, taking another 10 years in a journey that should have only taken a couple of weeks, really, or, you know, not that long. Anyway, jokes about Google Maps and voice agents telling you where to go. Zeus's Law. Xenia, not Xena, Xenia, although it is the same root word. Hospitality, not just making a cup of coffee or tea for your guest. It is a very important concept in the film. Perhaps the Trojan War's original sin too, where Paris swans off with Helen or vice versa, violating several laws of hospitality that you pay to a guest and that the guest is expected to also uphold. You get to be rewarded or you pay a price. It's very interesting things about this hospitality thing. Any guest could be a god in disguise, so it says. So, you know, in an age when travel was important, it was actually quite a big thing to have guest law in place to look after people because it could be turned around upon you. You might be travelling someday and need hospitality. And I was thinking the other day that the guest law, Zeus's law, works very well for bards and rhapsodes, considering that who you think about is propagating the Homeric epic poems, treating the person well who's singing it to you, having that built in to the story is actually pretty good when you think about it. Just occurred to me just recently. Xenia, Zeus's Law, a critical factor in Nolan's quite complicated film. I love the way that they've used that thematically. And, of course, that echoes into the 21st century right now, considering how we treat guests and immigrants and so on in the world. Other factors in there, kleos, glory or renown, a big thing in classical epic poems. Although I do notice that Odysseus actually doesn't meet Achilles in this way, or Achilles' shade, his ghost, in the Odyssey book. The poem, Achilles tells Odysseus that the glory wasn't worth it after all. I suppose the glory of Odysseus is to be forever suspended in the epic poem, the Odyssey, in adaptation after adaptation. The medium of memory is his bittersweet glory. Then, of course, there's Nostos, the journey back home, back to himself. He's a war veteran suffering from post-Troy siege disorder and the consequences of that. He is haunted by what he did at Troy in this. Amongst other things, he's responsible for the fall of the city. And I found out the other day. According to some sources, Odysseus is responsible for the original treaty, the pact. Helen of Troy initially was the subject of a lot of competition to be the queen of, or the princess of, various lands, and there were very many suitors for her, echoed, of course, in Penelope's panoply of suitors in the Odyssey. But anyway, there were lots of people vying for her hand in marriage, so much so that it was causing conflict and threatened to cause a war in itself. Whoever won her hand would be immediately set upon by the other unsuccessful suitors. And it was Odysseus, according to some sources, who created the pact that said, well, no, well, we'll When the suitor is chosen or is chanced upon, however it's going to work, the other suitors will all pledge to support them afterwards. And, of course, when Helen was stolen, that pledge pulled into play the treaty, the pact, and it meant that all of the other suitors had to go as well, to go off and fight the Trojan War. That's not the only reason, which is covered in this film. There are some other reasons to do with trade routes. Of course, in Troy is hypothetically in the Dardanelles, perhaps really too. There's lots of other things that I can't go into now because of time. And, of course, that's a choke point, as we found out in World War One, or as we knew then. The irony of all those classically trained officers and stuff in the British Army, at least, sitting in those wine, looking out across those wine dark seas of the Homeric legends, must have been palpable at the time for those poor fellows. Then, of course, there's hubris, not quite as important in this one, although there is some of the religious aspects to it, the Greek original ancient religion, you know, Zeus and so on, and Athena particularly, the overstepping of boundaries, either mortal or immortal. These don't actually have to have been imposed by the gods to be important in the story. So, yeah, a lot of those little aspects that I think that Nolan has brought together very well to give a story that I feel, of all of those adaptations I mentioned before, of all of those ones, I feel it's stronger than those and provides a good log line, a through line for the film that they keep coming back to, as well as providing a very interesting twist in the story later on. We also have an overarching meta threat too, which I feel kind of replaces the gods in some ways in this one, of the sea people, a mysterious and historically important factor about people providing this sort of existential threat in the story, in the film in particular. So, yeah, all right, the cast in this, we've got Matt Damon playing Odysseus. He captures the physicality of the character. I mean, he's obviously buffed up. Again, once again, we're saving, trying to get Matt Damon home, but never mind about that. He is really, really steeped in the guilt about being the man who's basically destroyed the city of Troy, or provided that with his amazing strategy and his his iconic engineering skills, really, when you think about it. He is a problem solver. He provides solutions, and this is where it gets him. He is no longer the same man who left Ithaca 20 years ago, not just because he's aged, but he's been through a lot. He is now a veteran of these terrible wars and the even just as terrible trip back home, where he loses pretty much all of his crew along the way, and not just from one ship, but of the whole fleet from Ithaca. So that clearly weighs upon him so much. And it's, it must have been resonant to the soldiers of the time and every person who's ever served in any military capability at all who was listening to a performance of the Odyssey back in the day. He also gets a really good line, I thought, in this when he talks about disguising himself as a beggar. He says, "The clearest view of a man is from below." That's pretty spot on, really. I think Damon is great in this. The only other person who I would really have liked to have seen play Odysseus is Sean Bean, who was Odysseus in the Troy movie, in Wolfgang Peterson's one. I would have paid good money to see him go on with that role at some stage. But no shade upon Matt Damon, not even the shade of Odysseus's mother in this case, who they omit from this story. Tom Holland plays his son, Telemachus, Prince of Ithaca, determined to find his father. He's very trapped in this one. I've seen a lot of adaptations where that is the case. This one, he is particularly enmeshed in the dilemma that he's facing. We get to see his journey too in this. We don't always see that, not just a metaphysical one, and also the journey to find his father again, who actually finds him first. The physical one, where he goes off to see King Menelaus, which is, of course, is John Bernthal, the Punisher, and his wife, who is Lupita Nyong'o, who played Nakia in the Marvel Universe. So we get to see that too. I think Tom Holland does a really good job with this. He's in the shadow of his father, even when his father isn't there. But he's also in dispute with his mother. He doesn't necessarily agree with her strategy. And he comes a real cropper when in front of Anne Hathaway, who is brilliant as Penelope, he says something like, you know, the throne has been empty for 20 years. And she just looks at him and blows up, basically, because she's actually been ruling the kingdom. Oh, yeah, there's a high council in that, but it's the fact that she is the queen of Ithaca, with basically her husband's authority as well. That's kept them going for 20 years. So, yeah, she's a bit peeved with that. I love the way she plays Penelope in this. I would love to have seen more of her character in this film, as we see more of Penelope in the Ralph Fiennes movie, The Return. But you know, it is a big movie, and there's a lot to get through. And you know, they try their best to get everybody. But all I can say is this: all of the female characters in this movie, all of the women, the actresses, they do such a good job of stealing every scene that they are actually in the film. So there is that. Robert Pattinson plays Antoninus, one of the Penelope's suitors. he is one of the sleaziest bottom feeders that I've seen in adaptations of The Odyssey, and he has done very well in this. Most creepiest, sleaziest, awfulest villain in this film. Lupita Nyong'o, who plays Helen of Troy, and her identical twin sister, Clytemnestra, who, as I mentioned before, murders Agamemnon on his return from Troy. She does amazing things with the little screen time that she has. Reinforcing, it's almost like the female characters in this are all reinforcing the same tropes along the way, the same themes of the film, in which case that means that Samantha Morton, who's playing Cersei, the transformative sorceress, is also important in just the fact that she too has PTSD for assorted reasons. So, yeah, they're actually one character who echoing the same theme throughout the story. Zendaya plays Athena, and it's a toss-up whether or not she's actually supposed to be the real goddess or the notionally real goddess or a conscience for Odysseus, as is Charlize Theron playing yet another aspect. So I actually feel like this is a very strong feminist piece in its own, echoing similar themes in Margaret Atwood's work on it, and also Emily Wilson's translation of The Odyssey. A couple of other people, Himesh Patel plays Odysseus' second-in-command, who I've seen recently in the HBO series Station 11. Bill Irwin does a great job as Polyphemus, the son of Poseidon, the Cyclops. He was doing some of this work on Interstellar for the TARS and CASE robots in that. And, of course, Elliot Page, who played Kitty Pryde in X-Men The Last Stand, appears as Sinon, a Greek soldier, and the son of a servant of Antinous. There's a nice little backstory going on there as well. All important characters in this film, which is very much an ensemble piece. Love the costumes in this film. I didn't care if they weren't wearing the original sort of armour that maybe they might have worn, etc. I would have liked a bit more have a bit more clunky sounds too, to give me the fact that it was actually bronze armour painted black or blackened by various metallurgical means or whatever. But yeah, look, I thought it was a magnificent epic. It is The Odyssey. It's Christopher Nolan's one. Loved to see it at the IMAX. It was. Thank you for that. Might be hard to get in tickets now because it's been sold out, but they are doing new releases. You can see it anyway at VMAX and the other large screen formats as well. But yeah, one to actually see at the cinema because it's like being there. Well, that's it for Zero G for today. And coming up next, we have Astral Glamour. All right. Thank you, Rob. And thank you, Christopher Nolan. I really do like a great historical adaptation and an adaptation of The Odyssey in particular. And we'll go out with a little bit of sirens from...
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R's Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.